Well, as you can see by the title, we're going to talk about the authority. So let's spend a few minutes talking about this important subject. We'll do that by starting with a couple of definitions. If we just were to take an English dictionary, it would say the power to enforce laws, exact obedience, command, determine, or judge. When we turn over to a biblical dictionary, something like Vines, we find strength to exercise power, or the power of one whose will and commands must be obeyed by others. And so you'll see that when we think about the subject of authority, we're talking about having the right, the power to exercise your will upon another. And we deal with this type of thing all the time. A quick example is over in Genesis chapter 39, where I had you turn. And just to show very quickly what we're talking about, maybe just a very easy way to look at this is found in verse 4. So Joseph found favor in Potiphar's sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. So there's just a good example of how he oversaw all of Potiphar's things because Potiphar gave him authority, the right to exercise and the power to have exercise or exercise that power over all of the things that he had in his house. Of course, we know how the story goes. But then when he is thrown into prison, you see the same thing down in verse 23. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it to prosper. So same thing. He gets thrown in prison, and then he's put in charge where everything that the prison guard keeper has is all under Joseph's authority. And in fact, you think about the fact that he would turn these things over, or Potiphar would turn these things over, and then not worry about Joseph because of his integrity, his honesty, and so forth. But it just shows that whatever Joseph would say, that would be what would be expected to be done. And of course, then he rises up to the second in command under Pharaoh, and Pharaoh pretty much does the same thing and leaves him in charge of everything. So that is, Joseph then could say, we need to build this, or we need to do that, or we need to store that, and that's exactly what would be done. So in each case, what Joseph determined to do would be under his charge, and that's what would be done. Most of us, I know, we understand the subject of authority because we deal with it all the time. We understand it as at an early age, just when it comes to a child and their parents. It doesn't take a child to realize very long that the parent has the rule over you, has the authority over you, has the power to exercise that authority over you. We see it when a child goes to school, and at least this should be the case, that they would recognize that they're not in charge. The teacher is in charge of that classroom. They are the ones that have the authority over that classroom. And then it doesn't take long to realize that it is the principal then that has the authority over the school. And of course, in all of these examples, that authority has been something that's been given or handed down. A school officer, he goes through the school and he's got a, we observe, you know, think of a child, he sees the school officer and he's carrying a gun, he's got a badge. And what is that? That's given him the authority over the law, to execute the law, to enforce the law. When you get a part-time job, we don't usually like this, but we deal with this all the time. We have a boss. We have a shift manager, let's say, and that shift manager is the one who's been given the authority to say this needs to be done and that needs to be done. And so we find ourselves, because the operator, the owner of the business, has given them authority to do so, to run the shift. But a lot of people, they don't like to be told what to do. They don't like it at all. And so they buck against authority. And we recognize that that becomes a problem. And we don't like somebody having the right to do that. And so we challenge that. And we think, well, they don't have the right to tell us to do this and to do that. But we recognize that when it comes down to it, so many times we find out we were wrong, and they do have the authority to be telling us what to do. But the important question is there someone in charge of all of mankind, all of creation, all of the universe? You and I are here this afternoon because you believe that's true. And so I'm not talking to anybody that doesn't believe that is true. At least I hope not, that we're not talking to anybody that doesn't believe that there is someone that has charge of all of mankind, has charge over all of creation, has charge over all of the universe, as vast as it may be. There is a supreme being. Well, others, while they may not believe there is a supreme being, or they may not believe in the God of the Bible, what do? Well, you call God's revelation into question when you would say there is no God or there is no supreme being. And so if you just think about world religions in general, there's many world religions that don't believe in the God of the Bible. Not the Bible, not the God that we read about that created the universe, and there's the history and the story of God's plan of salvation. They don't believe in that. This is not the book that they study. They follow some other man-made type of religion. And that may be the case. But when you just think about creation in and of itself, turn over to Romans chapter 1. And this is really a bedrock scripture when we think about God and we think about just how powerful it is as Paul is talking about what creation teaches us by just looking and observing at creation itself. We can see that, and we can learn a lot about the existence of God and the truth that there is a being, God, that is in control, that did create. And so it says this in verse 20, "For since the creation of the world and creation of his world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." And so basically, when we look off into creation, and I find myself doing this. In fact, I read Tommy Peeler put something out, and if you're from Indiana, of course, you understand who Bobby Knight is, and most of you that are people that know anything about sports know who Coach Bobby Knight is. And growing up in Indiana, you were either an IU fan or you were a Kentucky Wildcats fan, and we were IU fans, and so Bobby Knight was the coach, and he was talking about people that Tommy himself has met that knew Bobby Knight. And of course, everybody has an opinion about who he is and what he did and the things that he did when he threw chairs and all of those types of things. But he told a story of him and the one that Tommy knew going out and out west, and they just started driving after their recruiting was over, and they took off driving. He said they drove for hours and they didn't see anybody, and then finally they see some cowboys off the side of the road. And so they actually stopped and actually sat down and ate with them and told stories and things of that nature. But what was interesting was on the drive back, he said, Coach Knight looked and said at the sunset, "How can anybody see this and deny that there is a God?" So creation itself screams that there is a creator. But not only that, but we also understand that he says that there is something said about his deity, the fact that there the Godhead. And so we look at creation and we start thinking about the power that it took to create all of it, this that we see, and the fact that you could have the power to speak something into existence, that you could say, "Let there be light," and there is light. And think about the fact that he says, "Let's separate the water from the dry land," and then that begins to happen because you spoke this into existence. And you think about that, and you look at the design, and you understand that this cannot be an accident. But creation even declares things about his very nature. And so just a few things as you think about this. So when we think about God's holy nature, we think about a divinity, which is the word that is used here, the Godhead, even as God, even the Godhead, that he is eternal, that there is self-existence. I think that this is very powerful in the fact that God, who created all of this, he doesn't need us. He's self-existent. And I can look and I can understand some of these things. And of course, revelation becomes such an important part. But to think about what is it that you would have to know? What kind of laws? To create water, to create heat, to create light. And then to think about the fact that he has to have some kind of understanding of things that are all over. When you think about the vastness of things, or you think about, again, his power, or that he is holy. Or when we think about revelation, we think about his perfection, his holiness. And so we look around and we see these things, and when we think about a creator, these truths give us an insight into God's strength. And when you think about his strength and his power, then that gives you a little bit of insight, doesn't it, into the fact that he can exercise that power over creation. If he created it, can he not then exercise his power over it to sustain it? And so you just start thinking about this idea of a creator having this inherent right over his creation, which also includes you and I, mankind, whom he also created. So if you start thinking about this subject of authority and this power and this right to exercise power, and you think about a creator, then you start getting an idea of this question that I raised, and that is there someone that has the power over all of these things? Look at a passage that is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. I'm going to throw this one in. I didn't have it in my notes, but 1 Corinthians 11, if you look at the first few verses, he says, "Now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the traditions just as I deliver them to you. But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, the head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God." And so there is this chain, if you would, of authority. We were talking about this morning about prove yourself a man, and that how the husband has been given the headship of the home. He therefore has the authority as the head of that home. Well, who's the head of the man? Well, all of us are submissive to someone, aren't we? Because the head of every man is Christ. And who's the head of Christ? Well, that's God. And so you see that there is this idea of one who has the right to exercise his power over another. So with all of these thoughts in mind, the scripture reading was, "All authority has been given to me," Jesus said, "in heaven and on earth." All authority has been given to me. And so that just makes that all the more powerful. And what I want to focus in on is, and we'll see some of this in that he has authority not only in heaven, but I'm interested more on earth. On earth. And so if we look at this kind of, as I was thinking about the purpose of the lesson, if we're looking at this from the standpoint of kind of how would you start in an initial thought on authority, this is kind of what I'm really wanting to do. And it's the fact that someone has that right to exercise that authority. And if we can grasp that, if our friends can grasp that, if our religious neighbors can grasp that, then they're going to turn to the scriptures to find out, do I have the authority to do this? And that's kind of where we'll end. The Father gave Jesus all authority, Matthew chapter 28 and verse 18. If something is given to you, does that not apply that someone is the giver? And Jesus said, the Father has given me authority. He's not only just given me authority, he's given me all authority on earth. And so that's why in John chapter 17, in the first four verses, as Jesus is about to go out and be crucified, he prays. We have his prayer in John 17. Read the first few verses and thoughts of this prayer. Verse 1, Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son in that your Son may also glorify you. As you have given him authority over all flesh, that he should give eternal life to as many as you have given him. And this is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. I have glorified you on the earth. I have finished the work which you have given me to do. The Father gave Jesus authority over all flesh. Now that's the same thought about Potiphar giving Joseph authority over all of the things in his household. You remember he said, now there's one thing, Potiphar, as he's talking to his wife, that your husband did not give me power over you, but everything else, yes. Now Jesus says that I have been given all authority. And that's the same type of language that the Father gave him over all flesh. And Jesus' authority is a divine authority that's given unto him. I would not say that when Potiphar gave Joseph authority over all of his things, that that was some kind of divine authority, would you? Because when we're talking about divine authority, we're talking about divinity, we're talking about God. And so God is giving his Son, Jesus the Christ, authority over all flesh. And that would include who? Well, that would include me. That would include your neighbors. That would include your family. That would include everybody that he's been given authority over. In Luke chapter 9, or excuse me, 10, I want to look at just an example here of, again, this idea of giving authority. And this will become a root, if you would, of how important the apostles are, Jesus' disciples are, that he sends out. So in chapter 10 and in verse 19, this is when you'll have a heading there that says Jesus sends out the 70 there at the start of the chapter. So this is called the limited commission, where they go out and they come back. Well, if you look at verse 19, behold, I have given you authority to trample upon serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall be by any means hurt you. What's my point? Jesus would turn around and he would take what authority has been given to him, and he says, I'm giving that to you. And that would allow them then to have these supernatural abilities here to do that. In fact, when they come back, they're overjoyed. They can't believe it. And he says, that's when he said, I saw Satan falling. And so I just want you to see that one with authority can turn around and say, I'm going to give you that authority. Just like the Father, there's going to be occasion where Jesus will give that authority to another. That will become important, of course, when you think about the subject of authority. When you start thinking about the scriptures and you start thinking about Jesus gave his apostles authority, so their words become authority. And so we would want to understand that. But these are the words that Jesus gave, and their authority is the authority of Jesus. And so what they do by way of example, would that not be something to determine a course of action? There's a lot of debate sometimes about an apostolic example. Do I have to follow an apostolic example? Well, if Jesus gave them authority, and then they go out and this is the way they conduct themselves in a matter, does that not become authority in and of itself? I think you can see that point. The way to do something. There's a lot of people that cannot see that point. And that it may be a very simple point, but again, there are a majority of individuals, especially in the religious world, they don't practice the scriptures because they don't see that point at all. They don't see the truths of the subject of authority. That if Jesus, who's been given all authority, would give the authority to these men, then they would have, we would call that an ambassador that has the weight. The messenger of the king would carry the messenger of the king himself. You know, depending on how you look at this, their practices aren't based upon the word of God or maybe an example in how something was done by those that were inspired, those that were going out and teaching. Their practices are based upon what we like, what we dislike. I tell you, it's really amazing to watch the denomination on the way home. They have more fall festivals and more bounce things and more whatever, and they are so proud of their new facility. And I told you the other day, I went and looked, and their new facility is nothing more than just a gym and a way to have fun. And that is their, do they ever give thought? Do we have a right in the name of Christ to practice these things? Is this how we, and remember I told you they put a sign over their sign and it says, pardon our renovation kind of thing, because we're making room for you. What are they saying? Come and join us and have fun. Do they ever think that is this the way that you bring people to Jesus Christ? Well, I know I've been reading the scriptures a long time, and I can't find where that's how you drew people in. And so people don't understand this idea of someone having authority to exercise the and has the power behind it to exercise and say, this is my will. And then Jesus being able to say, I'm going to give it to these men, and whatever they're telling you is exactly what I'm telling you. And people make mistakes all the time. So the question I thought when I got to this point, I thought, well, is there any truth about Jesus that would substantiate the fact that he has the power to exercise this authority over the earth? Is there anything that we can turn to that would say, here's how he has authority? Well, I could think of John chapter 1, in the beginning was God, and the Word is God. So I would think that would give him authority there. But just think about his power that he exercised even over creation. We mentioned on Wednesday night the turning of water to wine in John chapter 2, verse 1 to 10. Tim, if I brought you some water, there's no way in the world you could turn that to wine. Would this not be a way of demonstrating the fact that he has power over creation? What about when he, in Mark chapter 4 and verse 39, controls the winds and the waves? Remember, he's asleep. He's asleep down in the boat, and they think they're going to die, and they come and they wake him up, and he says, peace be still, and the winds and the waves quit. What about in Matthew chapter 14 and verse 26 when he comes walking on top of the water? He's out in the middle of the sea. There's waves that are tossing. And he's walking on top of the water. Would that not show he has some type of power over creation? What about when he took the two small fish and the five barley loaves and he fed 5,000 people, and then they took up leftovers? Power over creation. And so we would learn in Acts chapter 2 and verse 22 that these miracles, these signs, these wonders are the things that showed that God approved of him. They also demonstrate that the evidence that's necessary, see, this is why you try to dismiss a miracle. Why do you think people today try to say, oh, that didn't happen? That couldn't happen. Let's see if we can't find some natural way for this to happen. Because they don't want to believe in the scriptures, which tells and records of miracles that he has done. And so that's why when we talk about miracles, we talk about, well, listen, I wasn't there, but what did the eyewitnesses have to say? What did they see? What did they think? And so we can see that the miracles would provide the evidence necessary to show his authority over creation. But it doesn't stop there. What about his power? And I said, I wasn't going to focus on this, but just to mention it briefly, but this would be his power over the spiritual realm. All authority has been given unto me, both in heaven. That's a spiritual realm. That's a realm of beings that I don't have any, I don't see them. I read about them. They're God's messengers. There's God's servant. But you also had these unclean spirits. So look at Mark chapter 1 and verse 27, where you have an example where Jesus has control over that unclean spirit. It says, they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, what is this? What? No, I'm sorry. Let me get in the right place. 127. I don't think I have the right... I don't have the right reference there. Let's see, chapter 2. Nope, got the wrong reference. The eyewitness's response. Look at Luke chapter 4. This is one of the miracles that he did with regards to over the spiritual realm. Chapter 4, verse 36. Casts out an unclean spirit. They were all amazed and spoke among themselves, saying, what a word this is, for with authority and power he commands the unclean spirits, and they come out. What did they see? They saw he had authority over unclean spirits, and they were amazed at that. That's the eyewitnesses' response to what was going on. What about his power over infirmities? Look at John chapter 9. This is when he heals a blind man. This is one of the stories in the Bible that just, it really shows how blind and stubborn that the rulers could be, just as they were prophesied that they had eyes but they couldn't see, ears they couldn't hear. They would be stubborn because Jesus, this is when he takes some clay, puts it on his eyes, says, go wash yourself in the pool of Siloam. And he goes, and this man that has never once in his lifetime seen anything comes back and he can see. And all they want to know is, who did this? And here's what he says in chapter 9 and verse 25. He says, one thing I know. Though I was blind, now I see. You remember, this is when they go on this hunt. They want to know from his parents who did this, and he says, I told you. And in that context, he says, you know, they thought he must be a sinner. He says, I don't know if he's a sinner or not, but I'm going to tell you this. I was blind, but now I see. What man, if he did not have authority and the power and the right to control whether a person can see or not see, if it wasn't in fact someone that had the authority to do so? What about in Mark chapter 7? Here you've got somebody. Have you ever met a man who is deaf and mute? And those two really kind of go together, because if you can't hear, you really don't know how to talk. And we certainly know that to be true with the history of Helen Keller. I worked with a man back in the crossbow manufacturing that was deaf and mute, and what came out of his mouth was really his attempt to try to say words that was very, maybe one time you'd understand what he had to say. But here we find in this particular text in verse 37, they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He makes both the deaf to hear and the mute to speak. Now, who could have control over something like that if he didn't have the authority to do so, to have this authority over infirmities? Matthew chapter 4 and verse 24, it talks about the fact that they brought epileptics to him. Have you ever known an epileptic? Well, when I moved to Wisconsin to preach, Curtis was an epileptic. And Curtis would have an epileptic seizure, and I remember sitting, I would go meet him for, he was every morning, he, you know, they're very much a person of habit. Because if you think about it, they don't have a whole lot of control over a lot of things in their life. So every morning, Curtis would go down to the country kitchen, and he would sit there and drink a pot or two of coffee. And I remember sitting across from him, and he had a seizure, and he falls out onto the floor. And the waitresses who had seen it a bunch of times and me were down, and we're just kind of talking to him, and he comes out of it. And the next thing I know, he's sitting right next to me, and he doesn't even know what's happened. How'd you like to live with that? And yet, the epileptic, the paralytics, the disease, the sick people, it says he healed them, all of them. They brought him and he healed them. It just shows you, as I was talking about, it substantiates the fact that here is a man, by his very actions in these miracles, had been given authority over creation, over disease and infirmities. And here's one that's very important to us. And it's the fact that he had power, the right to exercise power over death. And so we know that there are three occasions where Jesus raises someone from the dead. In Luke chapter 7, it is the widow of Nain's son. Brings him back to life. Or it's Jairus' daughter in Luke chapter 8. Brings his daughter back to life. Or it's Lazarus, Mary and Martha's brother. Lord, he's been in the tomb 4 days. He's going to stink. Lazarus, come forth. And Lazarus comes forth from the grave. Power over death. Does Jesus have authority given to him by his Father? Absolutely he does. If Jesus has this kind of power over creation, which he does, doesn't this mean he has the power and the right to rule over me? You see how powerful that is? Does he not therefore then have the power and the right to rule over me? These thoughts lay a foundation. They lay a foundation for the importance of finding authority. Finding the authority for our actions from the one who died and gave us a new covenant, a new law, a new testament. And that's Jesus Christ. That's why we call it the Testament of Christ. It's His will in written form that we have today. And so when we understand that He's been given all of this authority, He exercised that authority, then we can then make this transition to say, if He's got that kind of authority, what is His will? What is His will? And that's what the New Testament is. And so we have to, in Matthew chapter 26 and verse 28, when we assemble around the table, I think it's important that we incorporate the thought that is found in this passage. For this is my blood of the new covenant. Well, this is Jeremiah 31 and verse 31 when he says, I'm going to make a new covenant with the house of Israel. What's he talking about? Well, the old law was just for the Jews, wasn't it? For Israel. The new law is for who? For everybody. All over the world. And what is unique about it is, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. Jesus gave His blood. That blood, when He died, there was a new covenant. And when that new covenant went into force at His death, there's now an opportunity to have remission of sins. That's something the old law did not do. Every year, you remember, they came together and the priest went in and offered sacrifice. That's what the Hebrew writer talks about. Not one time, every year. Every year. Not only did the high priest go in there for the people, he had to go in there to offer sacrifice for himself. But the Hebrew writer says that's not true of Jesus. "This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins." And so when we think about that, and we think about this subject of authority, then what am I going to do? Well, I'm going to seek the will of the King of the Kingdom. We've been studying in Ecclesiastes, how do you approach a king? Realize he's got authority, he's got power. Well, this is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords that has power given to him by his Father over all in heaven, you and I on earth. Not only that, but what about seeking the will of the head of the church? That's the King of Kings, is the same person that's the head of the church. What about the will of the high priest of the priesthood? Now, this puts him in a unique position, which the Hebrew writer talks about as well, doesn't it? He's not only a king, but he's the high priest. So, and not only that, he's the prophet that Moses said would come. So I will seek out to find out what is the will of the one who has all of this authority. But this is why people reject Jesus. And when you reject Jesus, you reject God. And this is why people reject His Word. Because if you accept this truth, it means that you're going to have to obey the King's commands. You're going to have to follow the biblical examples. And you're going to have to make necessary implications based on what you are reading. And that's the way you establish authority in all kinds of realms today. It's the same thing, same way we establish it in other areas. And so we seek the will of the one who has the right and the power to exercise us, that will. Now, what happens is when you can recognize this truth, it's going to circumvent the will of man. It'll also circumvent any traditions that man has. It will also outrule any desires or wishes that men may have. But so many people refuse to see this point. They refuse to submit. They refuse to be humbled by the power and the right of the Son of God. You know what that means? If I submit, I'm going to have to change. And that's where a lot of people say, not going to do it. I'll have to give up my unlawful practices. And the majority are not willing to do that. But I'm thankful because Jesus didn't lie, did he? He said the majority won't. The majority won't. And that's sad. Are there commandments? Yeah. Are there New Testament examples to follow? Yes. Is there any wonder why Jesus would say, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Because if you're not willing to lay your own will aside to follow Jesus, then you will not be saved. Because the Father has given him all authority, not only in heaven, but on earth. If you're not a Christian, you need to... There's a song in the songbook, "My Stubborn Will at last hath yielded, I will be thine and thine alone." Steve, I'd have you lead that. I'm not sure if you've ever led that one. But that's what it is. We have to humble ourselves and we have to recognize that we sin, and that sin has separated us from God. But we have a gracious and loving God that has given us an avenue, a way, through His Son, Jesus Christ, to be able to have those sins forgiven. Why not come this evening, be baptized, and wash your sins away? If you're a child of God and something's amiss, can we help and pray for you in any way as we stand and sing this song?